Thank you very much. So, yeah, as Eric said, I'm Chris. I'm the director of Intentional Care Support, and I live in Vermont. Although you may have, either you read in my bio or you're thinking that is not a Vermont accent. So just so you know, I'm from New Zealand. But I like to say that in case somebody asks me if I'm from Australia, which is a bit like asking a Canadian if they're from the United States.
Exactly.
Thank you for laughing, because when I say that here in the United States, they look at me like, what? So I'm glad you get it. So anyway, so how did I get here? Well, I started up my chief qualification for this is being locked up and on the sharp end of the needle, and realizing that basically it sucked, and I lost so much that was really dear to me. I lost my job, custody of a kid, my house. I had a mortgage foreclosure. I ended up having to go to the food shelf, getting charity help. Lost all my friends, and the really sort of ironic thing is that I was working in mental health services at the time. I was working as a manager on the other side, on the dark side, some of my friends call it, as a manager and a clinician. And I realized that the people who did most for me were not the people who were paid to be there. They were my fellow inpatients who sit beside me in the smoking room, where I took up smoking, because that's where the best conversations were. And I just have to say, you know, full disclosure, I still smoke the old cigarette, because I love, you know, the conversations, there's just something about it. So so I lost all those things, and so I got really angry. I reincarnated myself as a bit of an activist from hell, and ended up doing, and decided that I was never going to work on that side again. I discovered that there's a proverb that says the healer must find the wounded within, and the wounded must find the healer within. And that's what I really discovered. And so I decided that, you know, I was just going to embrace my identity as a mad person. And I lived sort of on disability for many, many years. Ended up doing some human rights work with the United Nations, with the Convention for the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And we were really challenging some of the notions that forced treatment is such a good thing, and we were trying very hard to get it out of the convention and to say that it's actually harmful, and that most times it does more harm than good to force people. And I realized that I needed to be looking for alternatives that actually work, and that's how I got how I found Intentional Peer Support. I was looking for ways of being that would enable us to be together, support one another, and, you know, to work to avoid being forced and to avoid coercion. So I ended up meeting Sherry Mead, the person who wrote Intentional Peer Support, and long story short, we ended up falling in love and getting married, and I lived in the United States as an illegal alien, yes, before I could get a visa and then a green card. Now I sometimes wonder why I would like to live here, but anyway, that's another story. But here I am. I'm in Vermont, and I'm now the director of Intentional Peer Support, because Sherry has Parkinson's disease, and she's not able to work any longer. She's lost a lot of her ability to be able to speak, so she supports me and I support her. So a little bit about intentional peer support. Intentional peer support is kind of different from a lot of other kind of peer support, because we don't believe that we're here to help people through. We don't believe we're here to sort of be junior clinicians, which is what some peer supporters and Eric, you talked a little bit about, sort of navigating the strange territory in the peer field. It's really about creating relationships that make us both okay for us both to be in relationships and to take a bigger look at how we've learned to make sense in the world. So so it's more about, I don't know if any of you, I mean, I guess most of us in our lives have been through some sort of hard times, whether it's our mental health stuff, whether we've lost someone very suddenly, had some particular kind of physical illness or trauma or loss. And one of the things that's most helpful is for many of us is people who've been there themselves. When I was quite young, my dad died. He was drowned in a fishing accident. And because I was very young, most of my friends didn't know how to deal with somebody who'd lost a parent. But what I noticed was that those who had were the people who made the biggest connections. And so that's in peer support, what we're working to create. However, in intentional peer support, we're very clear about what we want to do in relationships. And most of the relationships, particularly when we're got a diagnosis and sort of in the thick of that kind of treatment phase that a lot of us go through when we first sort of get caught by the system, is that most people see it as having problems. You know what it's like, people, all your family and your friends, they all say to you sort of, how are you? And you might say, I'm fine, thanks. And they say, how are you really? Anybody ever been in that situation? And what they're really looking for, what is it that you think they're really looking for? Anybody got a thought?
Maybe a mood level from 0 to 10.
Yeah. They're sort of looking for the dirt, aren't they? They're looking for the problems. And they're seeing me as a problem to be solved rather than as maybe I might be a friend, a lover, a parent, an artist, a runner, whatever it is that are my interests in life, all of a sudden I'm seen as a problem. And in intentional peer support, we really work to try and shift the focus from I'm here to help you because I'm the expert and you've got problems, to learning together. How can we learn, acknowledging that both of us have something to be able to contribute to the relationship. We try and we endeavor to shift the focus from you or the individual to building a relationship, and also from fear to hope. Because a lot, I don't know if you've noticed, but a lot of the focus in mental health is on what people are scared of you doing or scared of me doing. And so we try and do something a little bit different. There's four tasks that we talk about. The first one is the task of connection. And that is when you're connected, don't you, to somebody? It's just this sort of little magical spark It might be, you know, I mean, it can happen anywhere. It can happen in a conversation. It can happen in the supermarket. It just can happen in relationships. But that connection, it creates a sense of belonging, a sense that we're in this together, and it sort of builds trust. The interesting thing, and without connection, we don't really have anything, do we? So one of the most important things to remember is that disconnection comes as quickly as connection does. That could be anything from somebody lecturing you to feeling judged or criticized to somebody being patronizing. But disconnection happens, and one of the things we talk about a lot in intentional peer support is you've got the opportunity to be able to reconnect. Always, it's always an option. It may not be the best option, but it is always an option. And most of us have been brought up or learned to believe that if we're disconnected, it means there's something wrong with us or there's something wrong with the other person. We really talk about, is reconnection an option, and what might we do to reconnect? Sometimes it involves checking it out. Sometimes it involves a bit of an apology. Sometimes it involves just being honest about what really happened. The second thing that we talk about is worldview. Anybody there know what worldview is, or got a definition of worldview? Or
sort of like how, what lens we see the world through.
Absolutely. And how do I get that lens?
What might that leave us, or?
What created this lens for me? Yeah, the lens that I see the world through.
Well, for me, it would be like maybe family, or as well the community that I grew up in, the country that I grew up in, a number of different factors. Yeah.
Absolutely. So it could be your parents, your community, your race, your religion. It could be your eye color, your skin color, your height. Your education, whether you experiences of trauma or abuse, experience of success, privilege, power, the list is almost endless. But that creates the way I see the world. And so let's just say that I believe that money is the root of all evil, because I was brought up in a family who said money is really bad. You know, people with money, they're probably not happy. And you shouldn't actually, you know, it's actually bad to have money. And maybe you were brought up in a family who were very wealthy, who said money is really useful. It's a status symbol. It enables you to get where you are in life, to get what you want in life. And you need a lot of money, and you need to work to make sure you've got money. You and I might clash if you, with a lot of money, say to me, you know, Chris, what you need to do is just, you need to learn to save and invest your money. So, you know, there's a number of issues. Firstly, I don't believe money is a great thing. Secondly, I have no experience with money. Maybe I, you know, I live from disability check to disability check, and, you know, I don't actually even have enough money to buy a pack of cigarettes or, you know, something to, you know, a meal between paychecks. So, you know, we have very different worldviews. So we talk about that we can learn from one another. That if I'm, you know, thinking about worldview, then I might be curious about your worldviews and acknowledge that I have mine, but it's not right. It just is my own worldview. So that can lead us to sort of reflect on disconnecting, connecting, and reconnecting. The third task is the task that we call mutuality, and this is when we teach this, we often teach this to clinicians. They find this really, really hard. So mutuality is basically when your worldview and my worldview are both visible in the conversation. And this can be kind of a magic moment. I don't know if they had a therapist or a clinician or a doctor or somebody who has told you something personal about themselves. Mm-hmm. And remember it. You know? And why do you think it is that we remember it?
Because it's rare.
It is so rare. But there is something magical about it, if it's done at the right time in the right place, is that it's almost like they're opening a door and they're saying, I trust you and I see you. And I trust you enough to let you see me. And it can be a powerful moment. I sometimes tell the story about my doctor. I went to him to see if I could get 3 months' worth of Seroquel because I was going to travel. This is a long time ago. It was about 12 or 13 years ago. It was before I came over here, and my doctor said to me, can I trust you with that amount of medication? And I said, overdose has never been my method of choice. If I was going to off myself, I'm not going to do it with an overdose. It sort of seems like too uncertain. And my doctor said, it's always been my method of choice. Because I think I probably know enough about pharmaceuticals to know, how to really do it. And I tell you that story because it was a magic moment for me, because he let me know that he also at times thought about suicide, thought about killing himself. And he trusted me with that. And I was very moved. We laughed about it. We had this great sort of conversation about it. And so when we both have the courage to be visible in the conversation, that's what we call mutuality. Mutuality may be me saying to you, it doesn't work for me when you do that. I can't listen to you when you shout at me, or, when you talk about such and such, that's a hot button for me and I find myself shutting down. So mutuality is about both of our needs being met. And that sort of makes a living conversation. And the fourth one is what we call moving towards as opposed to moving away from. And I guess a lot of what many of us are used to is focus on what we don't want. How are you sleeping? How are you eating? Are you still having how are your thoughts? Are you still thinking about suicide? How's your anxiety? How's your obsessive stuff? Whatever it is. The score. But it's all focusing on what we don't want, isn't it? And I think a lot of us lose sight of where we really, who we really are, where we really want to go. And so we talk a lot of, and we work a lot with people to think about what if possible, how can we focus on where we want to go, what the possibilities are, rather than just getting sort of lost down the bunny trail of what we don't want, because it's a real life sucker. So that's the thumbnail sketch of intentional peer support. We take 5 days to teach this. So I've just given you the Reader's Digest version. we really, I mean, we work with people to be present to one another, and you know, and to have conversations that are hard conversations, whether it's about you know, be anxiety, whether it's about voices, whether it's about thinking about suicide, whether it's about self-injury, and we really support people to be present and to have a conversation and to listen for what's going on rather than to try and prevent something from happening. And you know, it would take a lot more than just sort of a few minutes. But you know, for example, when somebody says, you know, I just can't go on. I just can't stop thinking of dying. The traditional response is, oh, are you suicidal? Do you have a plan? What is your plan? You know, and there's this whole sort of pathway called an assessment. And we say, why don't we just connect and say, that sounds like a really rough place to be. You know, what's going on? What's happened? Because underneath those thoughts, there's a whole lot of feelings, whether it's despair or anger or hopelessness or isolation or whatever. And under those feelings, there's a story. And if I'm talking to you about it, there's something that I want from you. And it's not very often that I want you to call 911 or, you know, to get me locked up. Very rarely, in fact, I don't know that I've ever known. Once or twice someone has said that that's what they wanted. And then when we've had the conversation, they've said, that's all I knew. You know, I wanted to be safe, you know. But what I want from you is I want you to listen. I'm telling you this. I'm hoping that you will be present to me in some way. That's a very Reader's Digest version, and I don't want to get sort of too detailed because I want to also leave time for sort of questions and to talk more deeply about some of the things that you're interested in and concerned about. Yeah, and you know, we go so far as to just say, let's stop calling these mental health issues. Yeah. You know, many of us learn to call them mental health issues because somebody told us that's what they are. And let's just put that aside. There are other people out there who are paid lots more than we will be paid to do that if we choose to. To see them, and that's fine. Let's just talk about this as life. You know, one of the things that we talk about is that, you know, at some stage, all of us got told we had a problem or thought we had a problem, got sent to see a clinician and said, you know, gosh, I'm having a really hard time, I'm in pain, or I'm hearing voices, or, you know, whatever it is. And the first thing that person that we saw, that clinician did, was gave us a diagnosis, a label. And so we started to think about all of our experiences as these things called symptoms. You know, when I used to have a big feeling, I used to get angry, or I used to feel sad, and now I just think, oh, I'm having symptoms, I'm symptomatic, it's depression, you know, I'm happy, so I must be elevated. So we learn to speak in that language. So we encourage people to talk about, you know, talk about it in real language. Say, what does that feel like? What's going on for you? You know, what's the story that you're telling yourself about that? You know, it may or may not end up in all of this sort of being resolved. You know, to be really frank with you, I still live with some of those things on a fairly regular basis. You know, I just have other names for them. I'm not cured and I'm not normal. And I'm very happy to be that way. We say it's whatever works for you. And our hope is that we see biomedical psychiatry as one little small box. You know, it's like a closet or a lavatory. And most of us have been sort of stuffed into that box and told that's the only way, the only place you can go. There's only one path to wholeness and healing for you, and it's in this little box. And our hope is that we can take off the walls of that box or three walls of that box and say, look out there, there is this whole world of meaning-making options, ways of living world, communities that will, you know, accept you. And that box is still there. For some people, the medication or their treatment is what works. For some people, it's what works for me now. I don't want to say you've got to throw that all down the toilet and saying that you're drug free is somehow better and more virtuous than saying that that you're still taking medication. What I would say is there's lots and lots and lots of options out there. Some really good books. There's really good movies. There's a lot online. And you know, whether you decide to see it as a spiritual pathway, or whether you decide to see it a new way to make meaning in your life, or you know, whether you decide to change your diet, or exercise, or do a whole bunch of herbs, or whatever it is. That is a personal choice, and my hope is that all of us can support one another to find out what that is for you. I mean, I know people who are into crystal healing. I crystals do nothing for me. I don't even understand crystals. But I have some other pathways. Spirituality is important to me. I have some, dietary and exercise things that are important to me. Thinking about how I learn to make meaning, that's important to me. And each one of you will be different. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I found some pathways. I recently joined a choir at CAMH, and I'm sure you must be somewhat familiar with CAMH. No?
I am, yes.
Okay, so yesterday I played my flute, and it was one of the best outlets I've experienced in 15 years. It was really good.
That's awesome. Choral singing is something I love to do as well, so I really relate to that. I'm a musician, so music is very important to me.
I mean, and you're also not talking as an expert, right, Chris? I mean, I hear...
Thank you for clarifying. I am not an expert. Well, I was thinking, as somebody said the word expert earlier, that we like to say X is the unknown factor and a spurt is a drip under pressure. That's about as expert. Yes, I am not an expert. I just come sort of with my way of meaning and what I know and what's worked with for me. So we actually sort of hope to kind of dismantle the notion of expert and say we are each experts at our own experience, if you like. To be really honest with you, what we teach works in any relationship. I mean, it's the nuts and bolts of it is that this is sort of a universal principle, and this is what makes relationships work. We often have people in traditional services come to us and say, please help us, please teach us, we need to learn this stuff. And we've chosen to go if people ask us. So we've taught this material in some quite traditional services because we believe that anybody will benefit from it. And I have to say, when traditional service, people in traditional services hear it, they find it very challenging as well, because it challenges their notions of thinking of people as sick, thinking of some people as the experts, and thinking that just sort of telling people what to do and setting them goals, which, you know, I think many of us get goaled out in the mental health services. I think that experience is shared by all of us. I don't know a person who works in this movement or does this sort of work who doesn't have that that same experience. And I guess, you know, that's something that our communities have put on us. It's not that there's anything to be ashamed of. So what we're working to do is to say, working with communities really.